Hi there. This is the podcast designed to lift you up and make you feel better about life in the world of primary care with some free CPD thrown in too. We've got some primary care pearls of wisdom to share with you to make your life easier. Coming up, we're talking about building conversations about physical activity into our consultations. Scabies, how do you spot it and manage it? Deciding if a baby has a non-acute asymmetrical head or not, and everything that you need to know about the brand new UK HSA National Measles Guideline released in January 2024. Please listen as soon as you can to ensure that you have full access to all of the free resources and hear about how crossed wires in a consultation led to a red-faced moment. But I can't do all of this by myself. Who's going to keep me company?
I'm Caroline Green.
And I'm Nick Kendrew.
We're both part of the Redwell team.
Come with us to reignite your passion for primary care.
Welcome to a warm hug of a primary care pod from Redwell.
The Primary Care Pod from Redwell.
And let's start with the Pearl headlines. Actively beat the New Year blues. We all know that New Year is a notoriously terrible time to try to embark on drastic lifestyle change, but becoming more active is achievable. We're going to discuss how we can build conversations around physical activity into our consultations.
Scabies surge, spotting it and managing it if you can get hold of the treatments. So scabies can be difficult to spot and tricky to manage, both because the treatment has to be applied in a very specific way and because there's a shortage of both of the first-line treatment options. So we'll try and unpack that one.
His head is all squished on one side. Now, this could mean many things, but hopefully, if this is a call to general practice, this will be a worry about a baby's non-acute asymmetrical head.
And measles, an update. In January 2024, the UK HSA declared a national health incident due to a significant measles outbreak in the West Midlands. We'll unpack the brand new UK HSA National Measles Guidelines and help us all spot this in primary care.
So as you can hear, we've got lots coming up and back to the top of the list now. So here's our first pearl and actively beat the New Year blues. So Caroline, what did this one mean for you?
Well, to be honest, by the Christmas break, I was pretty exhausted. And so after a pretty lethargic Christmas, this was the one that gave me a massive kick up the bum to get back off the sofa and start moving again.
Yes, and this one had lots in it. So including clicking through to the moving medicine link, it took me about 18 minutes to read it in total. But my goodness, there's some great stuff in there. And you'll feel hugely uplifted by the end, which is good to know. Now, we're going to pick out some of our personal highlights. But if this is something that you're inspired by, then we really recommend reading the whole article and perhaps look out for our lifestyle medicine course when it launches a bit later in the year. So here are the headlines for this one. Physical activity is a core pillar of a lifestyle approach to medicine and has physical, mental and social benefits. Inactivity is associated with 1 in 6 deaths in the UK. 4 out of 10 of us are classified as sedentary. The potential to have a positive impact on health through increasing physical activity is profound. So that sounds really important, Caroline. So how much physical activity is recommended?
Well, in simple terms, honestly, the more the better. Every movement counts and any movement counts. And that's actually great news because anything extra we do today or that our patients do today is better than yesterday. So yay. But back in 2017, a BJGP study suggested that 80% of us as GPs in England weren't actually clear on the national recommendations for physical activity, which isn't really massively surprising because they are not the most catchy set of guidelines to remember. So just in case you need a reminder, this is from the Chief Medical Officer's Physical Activity Guidance, and we're just going to look at adults here. You will find the guidance for infants and children in the article. Nick.
Yes, so the first message is to minimise sedentary time. and aim to be physically active each day. And we should be aiming for 150 minutes or more per week of moderate aerobic activity, or 75 or more minutes a week of vigorous aerobic activity, or a combination of these two. Now, muscle strength maintaining or building exercises should be doing, we should be doing that on two or more days a week, things like gardening and also resistance exercise. And old adults should also incorporate balance and flexibility training on two occasions a week. And remember that weight-bearing exercise helps to maintain bone health as well. So I completely see what you mean there, Caroline, about the guideline not being especially catchy or easy to remember, in fact. The truth is that many of our patients and many of us aren't achieving this. So let's think about why and what we can do to make a difference. Because whilst we know that our consultations are already packed, most of us agree that if physical activity was a drug, then it would be in high demand. So if we do decide to use precious consultation minutes to promote physical activity, is it worth it, Caroline?
Yes. So systematic review and meta-analysis have shown that even very brief physical activity interventions in primary care do work. And the bottom line is that people given advice by any health professional about physical activity tend to do 14 minutes or more moderate to vigorous intensity exercise in a week compared with the control groups who weren't given that advice. Now, that might not seem immediately that impressive, but actually at population level, it could have a really big impact. And actually, brief advice about physical activity is even more effective than smoking cessation advice, which we do routinely as part of our consultations. Everyone in the practice is doing it. In fact, for physical activity, it has a number needed to treat of just 12 to lead to a sustained increase in activity at 12 months. Now, for smoking cessation advice, that number needed to treat is about 35 to 120. Clearly, both are important, and we have to choose whichever one is more meaningful to the patient at that time. The challenge is, of course, it can be really hard to fit this in. And a BJGP study in 2022 looked at what were blocking us from doing it. And, you know, there won't be any surprises here. The barriers are a lack of time. Actually, some of us feel that we haven't been trained how to do it, and a perception that actually patients wouldn't listen anyway. Now, of course, in these days of the wider primary care team, I guess my question is this something we can share the load? You know, can we make it a real team mission to promote? And we'd love to hear your ideas on how you've made this happen, because we know there's some really great stuff going on out there. Perhaps in a week or two, you know, over the next podcast, Nick, we could do some physical activity primary care heroes.
Yeah, that'd be really good. And it's one of those things that's amazing to bind the team together and to have a common goal. So it's wonderful to hear projects like that going around. Now, another important barrier can be the perception that many patients, and let's face it, some healthcare professionals as well, think that physical activity might not be safe for them. And this is a really important myth that we can dispel, because often it's the very people who would most benefit who might hold those fears. So it was great news to us that in 2022, the British Journal of Sports Medicine published a consensus statement to support us tackling these myths. The key message is that the benefits of physical activity significantly outweigh the risks in almost all people with long-term conditions.
Yeah, interesting. Now, was anyone excluded from that consensus statement?
Yes, it's important to note that patients living with chronic fatigue syndrome, ME and long COVID were excluded. Now, excepting those groups, there were five key messages, and here they are. For people living with long-term conditions, the benefits of physical activity far outweigh the harms. Despite risks being very low, perceived risk is high. Individual conversations are essential for addressing this perceived risk, so that we can ask about this as part of long-term condition reviews, and that's what we should be doing. Everybody has their own starting point. And we can offer the advice that people should stop and seek medical attention if they experience a dramatic increase in symptoms.
Ah, now that's an interesting one, isn't it? So which symptoms are we worried about, Nick? Presumably not just slightly achy muscles.
Yeah, good point. So what we should be looking for specifically would be new or worsening chest pain, increase in GTN use if they've already been prescribed it, rapid palpitations, irregular heartbeat, dizziness, reduction in exercise capacity, or sudden loss in vision. And there were also some absolute contraindications to physical activity until controlled by appropriate medical management. So what were they, Caroline?
Yeah, none of these will come as a surprise. So the absolute contraindications to physical activity include a recent acute cardiac event, although interestingly, most of those people will ultimately be referred for cardiac rehab. They'll just have the supervision to do that. If we see ECG changes suggestive of significant ischemia, unstable angina, an uncontrolled arrhythmia that causes symptoms or hemodynamic instability, severe symptomatic aortic stenosis, acute PE, acute myocarditis or pericarditis, a suspected or known dissecting aneurysm, or an acute systemic infection. So actually, in reality, most of these are going to be things we're going to be calling 999 for. You know, they're not that context of a is it all right if I join the gym doctor type consultation.
And it's a lot to take in, isn't it? By the sounds of it.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, you know, the main takeaway is for most people, physical activity is a really good thing. But if we want, you know, if we have got patients who are worried about this, who feel lower in confidence, then Moving Medicine is a really fantastic website, and they have a great visual resource that summarizes that consensus statement and that you can print off or AQRX to patients. And there's a link to that in the article or the show notes. And I have to say, if you're using this podcast as part of your CPD and you do keep an action plan of things you'd like to do, put 30 minutes on it to explore the Moving Medicine site. It's funded by the Faculty of Sports and Exercise Medicine, by Sports England and Public Health England. And it's just got the most brilliant range of pragmatic information that helps clinicians integrate these conversations about physical activity into their consultations. It's also actually realistic about how much time we might have to do this. And so they offer options of the 1 minute, the 5 minute and the longer conversation. And so depending what your role is in the primary care team, you might want to look at different ones of those. And in our written pearl, we do offer an outline of the 1 and 5 minute conversation scripts, but the actual full resource on Moving Medicine can really link that to 21 specific long-term conditions and offer you scripts and stats that you can use in real-time consultations. So definitely worth a 30-minute CPD nugget. So if we are going to have these conversations, Nick, where could we start?
Well, a simple place to start would be to see if we can re-engineer movement back into our daily lives. And you might have heard people talk about this before, but it's about simple steps, really. And so this might be parking in the furthest space in the supermarket, taking the stairs, getting off a stop early on the bus. And the most appropriate activity for an individual is the one that resonates with their values. And it needs to meet their needs for social connection or bring them happiness, laughter, excitement, anything like that at all. It might not involve going to the gym or heading out for a run.
Yeah, I think that's so important because for lots of people, they have a like really negative mental model of exercise, and it often stems back potentially to childhood, you know, to that not being picked for the team or perceiving yourself to not be great at sport. And I mean, I can really relate to this. So I used to get the bus driver to write me a note to get out of games. I used to hide in the bushes during cross country because frankly, I was much better at Latin and chemistry than I was at running. So it's been really encouraging through my work at Red Whale and working with some of you great guys in the team to realize everyone can get more active.
Yes. And I love that story. It's like something out of Grange Hill, which is brilliant. So, so I just got this mental image of maybe you speaking to the bus driver.
So it may come as news to my parents and teachers.
Uh-huh. Okay. Was it a different person every time? Did anybody not notice the letters?
It was my best friend at school's uncle who was a bus driver.
Brilliant.
I only did it once.
Oh, bless you. Now, to try and reach who would automatically say that exercise isn't their thing, we could try looking beyond the obvious to activities like dancing, gardening, martial arts, sports, active travel. Now, these might resonate more with them, and this might be a place that social prescribers can really help us in mapping out and sharing what we have available in our communities. So we've probably all heard about doing 10,000 steps a day. Does that work, Caroline? Is that good?
Yeah, we often hear it, and it does really work well for some people. It can be really motivating to keep their streak going. For others, it acts as a real source of stress. So it's like all these things, it isn't one size fits all. But really important question, does having that daily step count have any bearing on mortality rate? And the short answer is maybe. So a USA-based population observational study tried to answer that question, and it included 5,000 adults, so reasonable size trial, all aged over 40, and they wore a thing called accelerometers. Now, these are just basically fancy pedometers. And what they found was that if you compared people who walked 8,000 steps or 12,000 steps a day with people who walked 4,000 steps, then those who walked more had a lower all-cause mortality. Now, that probably doesn't surprise us. Of course, it's an observational study and it only can show an association. And what's more, the measurements were only actually taken over 7 days. So we only know what their walking behaviour was for quite a short period of time. And the follow-up was only for 10 years. So that's why I say maybe, not a perfect study, but definitely no harm to try and increase your step count.
Exactly. Now, another thing that I often think about is, are we role modelling the behaviour that we'd like to see in our communities and getting the benefits ourselves? Well, it would appear that for many of us, the answer is no. The BJGP recently published a small qualitative study interviewing just 13 UK GPs. It identified that most were unhappy with their own sedentary behaviour, because many of us sit for more than 10 and a half hours on a work day, and I'm sure lots of us can relate to that. Now, the themes that they identified as barriers to activity may not surprise us, and they included workload, for example, having limited time for breaks, also their physical surroundings, telemedicine, professional roles and responsibilities limiting what they can do physically, sort of physical activity wise, and also poor weather as well. Now, the things that helped improve physical activity included owning a dog, and I can certainly vouch for that, and also using activity tracking devices and setting goals, though this could be a barrier if the goal wasn't achieved. Now, there was a clash between wanting to role model physical activity behaviour, for example, by exercising at lunchtime, and a perception of the need to be seen to be working hard by the public. And sort of taking breaks for physical activity could be perceived negatively. And I think that's really sad to hear that.
It's really, really sad. I actually, I read this study and I just found that it's just such a sad reflection on the state we're in as a profession, isn't it? That on the one hand, we want to do something that's a really positive role modelling behaviour, and yet we're worried how we might be perceived. And, you know, it's really sad to hear that. Now, if this is nudging you to think, actually, you might want to become more active as a practice, and we know lots of practices out there are doing this. I saw a brilliant thing on social media of a practice that had built like a mini gym for their reception staff in the practice. If you're that cool practice and anyone's listening, send us a message. It just looked amazing. But the Active Practice Charter is an initiative between the Royal College of GPs and Sport England, and it's designed to help you do just this. And basically, it's a nationwide network of practices that are trying to make positive changes for their teams. So team well-being, recruitment, retention, and also for their patients. It doesn't cost anything to sign up to it. It doesn't have to be led by a clinician. And it can focus on just really small changes that can have a big cumulative impact on physical activity and social connection over time. So we're going to give you a few examples that the Active Practice Charter suggests. They're mostly simple and inexpensive. If these are things that you fancy, add them to your action plan or take them back to the practice and see, you know, would anyone like to join you? So things we could consider, first of all, reducing that time we spend sedentary. So could you switch off the patient call system so that we walk to the waiting room instead? Could you install adjustable standing desks? So when we're on the phone, we might be able to do some of that stood up or moving around. Could we use seats that engage our core, like a stool or a physio ball?
Yeah, all of those things are really good to consider. And I remember we ended up switching off our patient call system because we found out it was going to cost a fortune to replace it. So it's really good for our physical activity.
Money's always a good driver, isn't it? Absolutely.
Now, to support increased activity, we might also encourage active commuting with initiatives such as the Cycle to Work scheme, which can make purchasing a bike more affordable. We can also use active transport for home visits if possible, maybe even having a practice bike. And some practice teams have done physical challenges, such as working together to accumulate active mileage. Now, this makes it social, and it can be even combined with fundraising as well. And it's something as a team that we did to increase physical activity with Red Whale probably about this time last year. And it was really, really good fun. So we kind of all got involved in that, and we had two different teams competing. There's also lots of ideas for patients in the Written Pearl for partnering with local physical activity providers, including Parkrun. And there are 1,700 GP practices in the UK currently being Parkrun practices. So you can become one of those if you want to. Also, the Ramblers Wellbeing Walk Scheme is out there, as is Healthy Walks Paths for All, which is based in Scotland. We also signpost to some sources for financial support, because without adequate funding or resources, making changes to our work environment or supporting patients to overcome barriers to physical activity can be challenging. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
So lots in that one. And I do recommend going back and reading the whole thing, because it is really uplifting to read it and you feel very positive afterwards. So here are our learning points for this pearl. To paraphrase Nice, exercise is anything that makes you slightly short of breath or brings on a light sweat. And you should do 2.5 hours a week of this in bouts of at least 10 minutes. Or you can do 75 minutes of a significant physical exertion a week, and that would involve hard breathing and a rapid heart rate instead. But remember, any activity is better than none.
Brief intervention works, even just 1 minute, and physical activity is safe and beneficial for almost everyone.
Linking activity to an individual's values and preferences and making it social and fun will help, and may help all of us in our practices too. So that's the first one done in a packed podcast. So Caroline, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I don't quite know what happened to January. It seemed to kind of go like that. What about you?
Yeah, I think lots of people were saying it really feels like it's dragging, and it kind of felt like it was never ending. But then when you look back, it did go in a flash. It's one of those really weird ones. I think you're just trying to sort of get over the whole Christmas thing and get back into work and get your head around the fact it's now 2024. How did that even happen? So that's what it kind of feels like. It feels like it's a bit, but it's calming down now.
Yes, I'm still writing the wrong date on things. And yes, I think ready for another holiday already. But
yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah, writing the wrong date is definitely a thing that happens for quite a while. And then eventually it just all blends in and it's all fine again, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Excellent. So let's move on to the next pearl then. And scabies. So what did this one mean for you, Caroline?
Well, this was the one that made me a bit itchy, to be honest, and a bit frustrated, because the shortages of medication that the UK is experiencing at the moment are really frustrating, aren't they? And they're just adding massively to the workload of general practice and community pharmacy.
Yes, yet another area where we have shortages of medications. Why is it that when we talk about itchy things that we start to feel itchy ourselves? Maybe if we look at the science of it, it will neutralise the itch. That's what I'm hoping, Caroline. So have you got a quick reminder about this?
Yeah. So, yeah, as a reminder, so scabies is a skin infestation and it's caused by Sarcopteris scabii. So these are little mites. They can burrow into the skin and they can lay eggs which hatch into larvae. I'm not sure this is helping the itch at this point, Nick, but anyway. So scabies is spread by close or prolonged contact. And this is the interesting bit. It isn't actually the mites themselves that cause the itch and the rash, but it's rather our body's immune response to the proteins in the mites and to their poo.
Ah, now that's making sense. And so is that why the symptoms can come on a bit after infection, and also why it can take a little while after treatment for the rash and the itch to settle?
Exactly. So symptoms usually start between 3 to 6 weeks after infection. And in some people, the immune response can take actually as long as 8 weeks. And the same is true once we give them some treatment. In fact, it can take quite a while after treatment for the symptoms to start to settle down. And that's really helpful to know and to communicate with patients, because it can reduce reconsultations about concerns that the treatment might have been ineffective.
Excellent. So that all makes sense in my head now. Brilliant. Thank you. So here's a bit of information on how to spot it. Now, for most people, the first presentation is itch, which can be pretty severe, followed by a rash. But an absence of itch doesn't rule it out in people who might not mount a full immune response, or who might not feel the itch. So the very young, the elderly, and those with neurological conditions or dementia. What does a typical rash look like, Caroline?
Typically, we might see raised and sometimes linear burrows, and good places to look are the webs of the fingers, between the toes, sides of the hand or feet, in the belt line, the genitals and around the nipples. Now, in some cases, you might see the mite as a tiny black dot, and that can be easier if you have a dermatoscope. But we won't always see a mite. It might have burrowed in too deep to see. And actually, if there is the typical history and a rash, we don't have to see a mite to make the diagnosis.
Exactly. And when we use a dermatoscope in this situation, we're using it as a big magnifying glass, really, aren't we? Just to actually see the little black dots.
Exactly. That's it.
And rather helpfully, we've got a link to some typical appearances in the useful resources section of the article in The Pearl. It's also on Red Whale Knowledge. And we'll also include those in the show notes as well. And am I right in thinking that we don't need to send off skin scrapings now?
Yes, that's right. Everyone can be relieved to know that we can make this as a clinical diagnosis. So if we suspect it, what treatment should we recommend?
Well, now, this is where it all gets a bit problematic for two reasons. Firstly, that it's to ensure that the treatment is effective. It needs to be applied in a very specific way. And then secondly, because there are intermittent shortages of both the effective first-line treatments. And this is causing real challenges for our community pharmacy colleagues. Now, the first-line treatment is permethrin 5% cream, which needs to be applied twice, once straight away, and again 7 days later, and the affected person and their household or all close contacts should be treated as close to the same time as possible. Now, if permethrin is not available or can't be tolerated, then melathion can be used instead. And it's important to say that there is no other licensed recommendation if neither are available.
Ah, excellent news. So if we recommend these treatments, it's really important that we provide information about how to use them to maximise the chances they're effective. And we said in The Pearl, these were the instructions we should give so that the cream should be applied over the whole body onto clean, cool, dry skin. That we should take extra care to ensure that all the skin is covered. So making sure under the nails, behind the ears, the scalp, and remembering to reapply the cream to the hands if you have to wash them within 8 to 12 hours of application. The cream should be left on overnight or for at least 8 to 12 hours. And all bed partners, any close family or carer contact should all be treated at the same time. In addition, after the treatment, you need to put on clean clothes, wash the clothes you were wearing and any towels and bed linen at 50 degrees or above on the same day as the first treatment. And then all of that needs repeating again 7 days later.
Yeah, so it's quite an involved process, as you can tell. If we are prescribing or telling a person how much they need of this treatment, then it's 30 to 60 grams of cream or 100 mils of liquid for an adult. And in children, unsurprisingly, it depends on their size. So you need to check the BNF for them. And now, affected people should remain off work or school, and they should also avoid close physical contact with other people for 24 hours after their first treatment dose.
Now, you might not remember all that. Don't know about you, Nick, but if you don't and you want some useful written resources or information to share with patients, you'll find some resource leaflets, again, in the useful resources at the end of the article or in the show notes. And I just also wanted to say a shout out and thank you to Dr. Joe Miller, who contacted us just after The Pearl was released, to share a further set of patient leaflets from the Yorkshire Humber Public Health Network in multiple languages, specifically designed to support the asylum population. So a big shout out and thanks to them. Those are also now in the article and in the show notes. So yeah, good to know. So what do we do, Nick, if people say they haven't got better?
That's a really good question, because this happens pretty frequently. Now, first, we need to remember that the itch can persist for up to 6 weeks, even if the treatment has been successful, because it can take a while for the immune response to settle down. Now, if the person is really struggling, then we might suggest simple measures like cooling emollients, or if it's really impacting on their sleep, then age-appropriate sedating antihistamines. Now, we need to remember that these can impact on driving, and that particularly for some children, it can cause hyperactive behaviours. So we need to be very aware of that when we're prescribing that. Now, Crotamitan cream is an alternative, and Urax is the only available one that we have in the UK.
Okay, I think I've got it now. Where else other than Red Whale would you learn about scabies, eh?
I know, exactly. But what if we were to get the dreaded call, there's a suspected outbreak of scabies at a care home or other close setting like a boarding school or a long-term hotel or hostel. It's worth saying that an outbreak is defined as two or more linked cases in an 8-week period.
Yes, well, don't panic is the first thing, unless you're the community pharmacist who knows there's absolutely no supply and this is happening in your area, in which case we're sending chocolate and sympathy. But don't panic. This will be a big job because everyone in that close setting is going to need to be treated at the same time. And while scabies isn't a notifiable disease, the good news is that the UK HSA can provide support in recognising and managing outbreaks. So if this happens to you, you might want to flick straight to the article, either as the Pearl, where it's available for the next 3 months, or in Redwell Knowledge. And there's specific guidance from the UK HSA. And we'll also include a link to that in the show notes.
And can we use ivermectin in this situation?
Yeah, good question. So permethrin 5% will still be the recommended first line treatment, but the UK HSA guidance on this do say that ivermectin is sometimes used off licence in this situation if there might be significant problems with topical application. But they also state that this should be decided by the local infectious diseases or dermatology team. So if you are a GP or another practitioner in primary care and you get involved in an outbreak, contact the UK HSA is probably our take-home message.
And on the back of that, here are your learning points for scabies.
So to spot it, remember itch and a typical appearance.
Remember that the itch and rash are caused by an immune response and therefore can take 6 weeks or so to appear and 6 weeks or so to resolve, even if treatment has been successful.
Treat the whole body and the whole household all at the same time and repeat 7 days later.
If you suspect an outbreak in a close setting, then speak to your local UK HSA team. And now it's time for the part of the podcast that lots of people love. And so thank you for sending in your stories. It's the best intention story. And this one, this time, is from another former trainee. And they start, "Dear Caroline and Nick, when I heard that your story last month was from a former trainee, it got me thinking about my time in training. Life seemed so much simpler then. My trip down memory lane also highlighted to me how much we learn from our mistakes. So let me take you back to when I was a trainee. My clinical room was the only one that had stairs to reach it. What I considered to be the proper clinical team were all on the main level of the surgery building. I had several patients that came to see me, and I happened to remark on their shortness of breath climbing the stairs. More often than not, after appropriate workup, these patients ended up with a diagnosis of heart failure that perhaps may have taken a little longer to reach if they hadn't climbed those stairs. Anyway, I'll never forget the patient that came to see me on the day in question for all the wrong reasons. She was a very elegant woman in her mid to late 60s, and her presenting condition was an upper respiratory tract infection and discomfort in her throat for a few days, what would be labelled as low challenge for exam purposes. As we were finishing with the presenting problem, she mentioned that she was worried about an intensive itch that she had in her vulval area. Now back then, I had a clinic booked with patients at 10-minute intervals, and I hadn't yet mastered the time management skills that we all have had to develop to be able to survive in our roles. "Of course I can have a look," I said. "Let me just go and find a chaperone." And so I went down the stairs on the hunt for help. Luck was shining on me that day because I bumped into my trainer. She was a fantastic teacher, and her knowledge about all things gynecological was unsurpassed. And more importantly, she was free now. We both went back up the stairs, and my patient was lying on the couch, her dignity preserved with some extra bedroll ready to be examined. As we were looking for clinical signs which would explain the itch, my trainer happened to ask her, "What brought you into us today?" "I had a sore throat," she said. I froze and could feel myself blushing like a beacon. "And then you told me that you were worried about itching down below," I said hurriedly. "Oh yes, and then this lovely doctor went and found you so that you could both have a look and help me." So that's why I'll never forget the first time I diagnosed a patient with lichen sclerosis. And my learning point is, when you get your trainer in to chaperone you for teaching purposes, make sure they know the full history to avoid awkward blushes like mine. So there we are.
Oh,
I'm sure that's all happened to lots of us.
Yes, well, similar things. I think that's why we like this section. It just takes us back, isn't it, to things that have happened to us. And yeah. Oh.
Yeah, a bonding experience, I think.
Indeed, yes.
So, Caroline, what's on the Redwell calendar for this month?
Yeah, it's a busy month. So we are just in the process of starting to prepare the new content for the next season of GP Update courses, which launch at the end of March. I know we're going to be doing some filming on ADHD and hepatitis C and lipids again, because NICE have updated their lipid guideline for the third time in less than 12 months. So that's really keeping us on our toes with our governance process. It's going to be a really good month for any of our unlimited members. So we've got Redwell Together events for GP Update, for contraception and sexual health, for menopause, MSK and chronic pain. So lots of opportunities to join the team live on the sofa to ask questions and meet with colleagues to learn and polls. And we're also doing various courses around the country. So give us a shout out if you're on the Staffordshire Men's Health course or the Devon Mental Health course. We'd love to say hi to any of you at any time. So yeah, busy month at Redwell.
Excellent. Thank you, Caroline. So let's now move on to our next poll. And this one is abnormal head shape in infants. So what did this one mean for you, Caroline?
Yeah, this was the one that brought back memories, a bit of a personal story. So when I had my daughter, as is common, I suspect, with lots of new parents, I spent a fair bit of time staring fairly aimlessly at the back of her head when she was feeding. And in those kind of early, hazy, sleep-deprived days of being a first-time mum, the sort of old medical school health anxiety feelings kicked in, you know, where you're convinced you've got basically every condition you're being lectured about. And I managed to completely reframe her slightly squished, normally physiologically molded newborn head to become completely convinced she had some kind of very rare craniosynostosis. Now, thankfully, my lovely GP was able to reassure me and help me to move on to worry about something else. But I certainly wished I'd had this pearl to look at then.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I'm sure that many of us listening to you can relate to that, either as a parent or as somebody trying to be that kind and reassuring primary care clinician. And this is one of those times where we need to know our stuff from the outset to really be able to help the person in front of us. It's a bit like being on a plane. If we hit turbulence and I start to panic, I look at the cabin crew. And if they look calm and relaxed, then I calm down. And if they look panicked, then I will start to escalate things. So how do we get to be in a position where we're able to reassure appropriately?
Yeah, so it's important to know that most of the time, a baby with an abnormal shaped head, this will be normal, either due to moulding in utero or the baby having a preferred position when they're lying on their backs or when they're at play. And this is called positional plagiocephaly. But occasionally it can be an indicator of a more serious problem, craniosynostosis. And this is where premature or abnormal fusion of the skull sutures, which should be unfused in the early part of life so the brain can grow, has occurred. Now, there are four main different types of craniosynostosis, either where one or multiple sutures have become fused. And in about a third of cases, it'll be part of a wider syndrome. But the type we're most likely to see in primary care is a single suture fusion that's not part of a wider syndrome. So if we see a parent that's worried about the shape of their baby's head, it's useful to have a framework in mind. How should we approach it?
Well, over the last decade or so, the BMJ offered two useful articles on this topic, which, along with some additional material, form the basis of this pearl. So first of all, we should take a history. When did this first become a concern? Has the head shape changed? The reason we're asking both these questions is because craniosynostosis will have been present from birth. We can ask if the baby has a preferred sleep position. Has it got a favourite side? Does this correspond with the abnormal shape that we see? We can also take a birth history. Was there prematurity or an instrumental delivery? These can both have an impact. What else should we ask, Caroline?
We can ask whether there's a family history of small or large heads, because in the same way tall and short stature can run in families, so can head shapes. And we can also ask if there's any other neurodevelopmental conditions or concerns. So things like possible seizure activity or feeding problems. Now, we know there's loads of trainees who listen to this podcast, and lots of them don't get a chance to do a paediatric rotation as part of training. So if you do want to brush up on your developmental milestones for your AKT or for SCA. You'll find there's a handy article on Redwell Knowledge and lots more PEDS topics there as well.
Yeah, great point. And even for those who aren't trainees, I'm always double checking that I've not missed anything when it comes to developmental milestones. So when it comes to examination, we should be measuring the head circumference and ideally comparing it to previous measurements. Is it very high or is it on a low centile? Or just as importantly, has the centile changed? We should also check the fontanelles. And here's a reminder, the posterior fontanelle usually closes between 8 to 12 weeks and the anterior between 12 to 24 months. Early or late closure may suggest a problem, as may any bulging. If you're not sure of your fontanelle positions, there's a handy picture in the article.
We can also feel along the suture lines. They're also on the image in the article. And if we feel a ridge or an elevation, that can suggest a possible problem. We should look at tone and for dysmorphic features that might suggest an underlying syndrome. So finally, you can compare the head shape you're seeing when you look from above with the images in the article, which show the four different subtypes of craniosynostosis, and contrast those with what we might see with positional plagiocephaly. It's definitely worth a look. It's quite a difficult one for us to describe in the audio format. So having done all that, what should we do next?
Well, the bottom line is that if we do suspect craniosynostosis, then we should refer. And this was a learning point for me. We don't have to go via a paediatric referral. Primary care can and should refer directly to one of the five specialised tertiary centres. Now, these are located at Alder Hey Children's Hospital in Liverpool, Birmingham Women and Children's Hospital, Oxford University Hospital, Great Ormond Street, and the NHS Scotland service based in Glasgow. And again, there are links to all of these in the article. So Caroline, would you feel confident enough to refer directly?
Oh, I'd be pretty nervous referring to a tertiary centre, but I don't know. I mean, I did a PEDS job in Oxford as part of my GP training. And actually, because that was one of the tertiary centres, I did see some cases of this. So I might feel a bit more confident than most. But to be honest, if I was unsure, I might phone a friendly paediatrician to discuss. And I think the key thing is that the craniofacial teams are very keen that referrals made as soon as possible because of the risks of raised intracranial pressure and the possible impact on sight or even seizures of untreated craniosynostosis. So they have this really strong wish that the children don't get lost in very long waiting lists or in a stretched system. So as we say in the article, if we are uncertain, we can share photos with our local services through advice and guidance. Now, Nick, what should we do if we're pretty confident this is positional plagiocephaly, so kind of the normal variant?
Yeah, good point, because we'll see this way more often. Now, we can be pretty reassuring about this because it usually self-corrects by 3 to 5 years and doesn't have any impact on development. We should encourage tummy time and supported sitting when developmentally ready and try to vary head position in sleep and play.
And what about helmets?
Well, there's no evidence that helmets are superior to just waiting it out, and they can be pretty expensive privately, up to £2,500, and they have to be worn 23 hours a day, which is a massive undertaking. Now, if you need a study to help you discuss this with parents, then there's a great RCT from 2014 published in the BMJ, and you can find the headlines from this in the article, and there's a link to the BMJ reference as well. So here are your learning points for this poll.
Remember, positional plagiocephaly is far more common, but to spot craniosynostosis, we'll need to think about it, measure and plot the head circumference, and feel the fontanelles and suture line.
If we have any concerns, then we should refer, and we can refer direct to craniofacial services if we suspect craniosynostosis.
We can offer reassurance and advice for positional plagiocephaly and reassure people they don't need to invest in helmets.
And our final pearl was entitled Measles and Update. Now, we covered this in the podcast and the pearls back in July, and unfortunately, fears expressed then about the risks of outbreaks have become a reality. And in January 2024, the UK HSA declared a national health incident due to a significant measles outbreak in the West Midlands. So we wanted to share the brand new UK HSA National Measles Guideline that has just been released. So Caroline, what did this one mean for you?
Well, this is the one that made me sad. And as we said back in July when we covered this on the podcast, it isn't that long ago that the UK had been declared measles free. And the vaccine hesitancy that followed the Wakefield misinformation scandal and also the misinformation that happened around COVID and vaccinations in general have all meant that in the UK, but also globally, vaccine rates for measles are at their lowest in more than a decade. And so we're seeing a resurgence of a disease that actually many of us were never exposed to during our clinical training.
So there are a few important things that we need to know. Measles is very infectious. A single index case is likely to result in 15 to 20 cases. So an R number of 15 to 20. Now compare that with what we were talking about with COVID when that was a thing. Mm. Now, immunocompromised people are at greater risk both of contracting it from a more casual contact and getting more severe disease. An affected person is infectious from 4 days before to 4 days after the onset of the rash.
And there are two key things for us in primary care. The first is spotting it so that cases and contacts can be isolated. And the second is maximising uptake of vaccination in our communities. So first, in terms of spotting it, and this learning you might want to share with the whole primary care team, although I'm sure, you know, we've all been bombarded with information about this. But measles presents with a sort of flu-like illness, with conjunctivitis and then rash. And if we're triaging by telephone and any case sounds like it could be this, then ideally we need to be seeing them either at the end of surgery or keeping them isolated in a side room if you've got the space. So from a receptionist perspective, fever plus rash equals potentially infectious.
And can you remind us what the typical rash and the course of the illness is, please?
Yeah, so typically the illness starts with a fever, and then quickly cold and flu symptoms tend to follow. Conjunctivitis comes next, and then coplic spots might be visible around day 3 to day 4. The rash usually starts from day 4 to day 5. So things we might be thinking of as a differential are roseola, scarlet fever, slap cheek and rubella. And there's a link to reviewing sort of the images and visuals of these different rashes in the main article, and we'll also share that with you in the show notes.
So if we think that we're seeing a case, then lab confirmation is essential and measles is a notifiable disease. So we're going to need to call our local health protection units, who will usually ask for an oral fluid swab. Now, we might be asked to follow that up with a blood sample and possibly a throat and or a urine test. Now, if the case is confirmed, then the health protection team will do contact tracing.
Yeah. And recently on the GP Update courses, we've been teaching a lot about post-exposure prophylaxis for chickenpox and shingles with oral acyclovir. So a really big change in practice. And that made me think, is there post-exposure prophylaxis for measles?
Well, yes, in short, there is, but it's reserved for those who are non-immune and high risk. And the health protection team will assess and decide this. So not one that we need to remember in detail, thankfully.
Now, because measles is so infectious, contacts who are not immunised will also be asked to isolate for the whole incubation period. And this can amount to a really significant time off work or school, so up to 21 days in some cases. Immunocompromised contacts might have to isolate for even longer. And the key message is that the UK HSA Health Protection Team will advise on an individual basis. So if we have affected patients, what do we need to look out for?
Well, most people can be managed symptomatically and will need to isolate and rest at home until they've fully recovered and for at least 4 days after the onset of the rash. And day zero is the first day of the rash. They can take paracetamol as they need to. However, some people will become very sick and may need admission. And the UK HSA say that we should consider this for those who are immunocompromised, pregnant or malnourished, and we would call them to discuss that. And for those with significant complications such as pneumonia, encephalitis, and in some cases otitis media as well. Then there's subacute sclerosing panencephalitis that we often think about as a late complication, and that can usually happen a few years after the initial infection.
Yeah. So the other key issue we're thinking about is vaccination, and two doses of the MMR vaccine are thought to offer lifelong protection against measles. But we need 95% vaccination coverage to offer adequate population immunity. And unfortunately, the current UK coverage is only about 85% on average and lower in some cities, including London and Birmingham. It's estimated that 10% of children in the UK are completely unprotected, so haven't had any dose of MMR, and that rises to 20% of the children in London. So we can make the biggest difference here by offering opportunistic vaccination to all of those aged over one who haven't had any or who have an incomplete vaccination history. And here's another reminder, if you're an employer, all healthcare workers, including our administrative staff, should have had two documented vaccines or a documented positive measles IgG antibody test. So maybe just worth checking in with your practice manager to make sure you've got that documented for your staff.
Yes. And if you're responsible at practice PCN cluster or ICS level for vaccine uptake, then you might find the article on vaccination schedules useful, which also includes links to information sharing strategies to engage with high risk and hesitant communities. So here are our take home messages.
Think about measles in a fever with a cold flu-like illness that's followed by a rash, particularly if there's conjunctivitis as well.
If you suspect a case, then contact your local health protection unit, who will ask for testing and contact trace if there is a case that's been confirmed. They'll also advise on post-exposure prophylaxis.
Promote vaccination to all unvaccinated or partially vaccinated people living in your community.
So just before we go, time for some primary care superheroes.
So first, we have Esme Chinara, who would like to nominate June Gray as a primary care superhero. June is the lead nurse at North Street Medical Centre in Romford. She's a great team member and always supports the others in the multidisciplinary team, including myself. I'm a paramedic, to optimise patient care. She's great with patients and takes time to explain and discuss chronic conditions. She's also a good champion for women's health and has taught me some great approaches to evidence-based practice and discussing contraceptive options.
And next up, we have Dr. Amma Basoa from South London. And we've nominated them ourselves to be a primary care superhero because they've written to us telling us how much they've been enjoying the podcast whilst they've been in hospital having some treatments. So a big shout out to you, Amma. Thanks for listening.
And Jenny Sim would like to nominate Nicola Pierce, practice nurse who works above and beyond, always ready to help and highly thought of by patients and colleagues. If you've enjoyed listening, then please leave us a nice review on whichever platform you use so that other people just like you can discover us.
All the resources that you need are in the show notes and all the links are in the show description on your preferred podcasting platform.
And you can also find us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. And if you want to see something about the podcast, then please use hashtag Red Whale Pod.
And the other thing that you can do, if you click on the link in the bio on social media, is to leave us a voice message telling us about anything that you've found helpful or you'd like us to go over again.
And for those who are more traditional like me, you can email us. Our address is podcast@red-whale.co.uk. So until next time, I'm Caroline Green.
And I'm Nick Kendrew.
And remember to keep Redwell knowledge open on your desktop at work, so we're with you when you need some extra information or reassurance.
Take care and look after yourself. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.